Hello, and once again, welcome to the Labyrinth Library Podcast. As always, for this past year, I do appreciate you being here with me. It's been a year. Can you believe it? 1 year ago, we started this adventure together, ladies and gentlemen, back with Good Omens. Oh, I remember it well, just like yesterday. But it has been a year. We've done a lot of talking about books. We've done a lot of reading. And first, as I said last week, I would like to thank you. This kind of thing, doing a podcast, is something that's a little difficult. Doing any kind of artistic venture, and I do believe this is, in some way, small way, an artistic venture, it is difficult without people telling you you're doing a good job. That's hard with art. Only the best artists can truly make their art without some kind of support. I am not one of the best artists, so it does help that I've had such fine people sticking with me and listening to the podcast. And so I thank all of you, not just the ones in Spain, everybody. You have all contributed to making this something that I look forward to every single week. I really, really do. So without any further ado, I told you this week would be a little bit longer because it's a special double-sized one-year anniversary edition, and that is true, and I gave you some hints in the form of some names. And the last two names were kind of the giveaway names, really. They were Kara Zor-El and Barry Allen. If you know those two people, you know what they have in common. If you know what they have in common, you know what we're talking about today. It is, as my brother guessed first, well done, Paul, and Esteve also guessed, The Crisis on Infinite Earths. It is a DC Comics event that happened, wow, long time ago. 25 years ago? 25 years ago? When was that? When was 1985? 25 years ago. Whose idea was that? Oh my god, I feel old. Anyway, congratulations to both of you. You were absolutely correct. It is The Crisis on Infinite Earths by Marv Wolfman and George Perez. Now this, ladies and gentlemen, is one of the works that has affected me deeply. More importantly, it is something that has caused, well, considerable harm to my wallet and my bank account as I've been collecting comic books for, well, now 25 years, and it's all because of Crisis. I can remember going to the drugstore after church one Sunday. Yes, I used to go to church. I know. Sometimes I don't believe it either. And I saw the cover to Crisis number 9. It was a classic George Perez group shot of some of the most terrible villains ever seen in the DC universe. I mean, you name the baddie, I guarantee he or she was in there somewhere. And I was hooked. Of course, coming into a 12-part series in issue 9 meant that I was really lost as to what was going on. But some effort and visits to comic shops eventually got me up to speed. Unfortunately, once I understood Crisis, I realized there was so much more that I didn't understand. You see, you can't really understand this story without understanding something of the DC Comics universe. And to help you out, because maybe you are not a comic book nerd, let me fill you in. In the late 1950s, they published a story called Flash of Two Worlds, Flash number 123, in which the Flash, Barry Allen, managed to, using his prodigious super speed, vibrate through some dimensional barrier or other and meet the Flash, Jay Garrick, whom he had read about as a child in, yes, comic books. The explanation for this was, well, simple. The guy who wrote Flash comics in Barry Allen's childhood had somehow tuned in to this other Earth and watched Jay Garrick's adventures, and thinking they were fiction, he wrote them up as comic books, which in turn inspired Barry Allen as a child. So when Barry was struck by lightning and chemicals and gained super speed, he called himself The Flash, in homage to his childhood hero. Anyway, in Flash of Two Worlds, Barry Allen finds out that the Flash he had read about actually existed, only on another Earth in another universe that vibrated at a different frequency from ours. Personally, I think this is a really cool idea, and my personal goal in life is to drink enough coffee in one sitting to accomplish the same thing myself. Anyway, if you're confused, yeah, a lot of people were. It did help if you were an avid comic books reader for 25 years before Crisis came out. You know, I had to find all this stuff out later. But to condense the whole thing, here you go. In the beginning, there was one. A universe that grew and shaped and changed. Life was created, it rose from the dust, and it began to think. On the planet of Oa, located in the center of the universe, life grew with great swiftness, advancing at incredible speed. The beings of Oa embraced science and research. One of them, a man by the name of Krona, sought to know the origin of the universe they inhabited. Despite the warnings of his colleagues, he created a device that would allow him to do so. The result was a complete rupture of time and space, for the beginning of things must never be witnessed. So, in the beginning, there were many. Universe upon universe, each one moving at its own speed and vibration, separated by the thickness of a shadow, but each one unknown to the other. That was the idea, anyway. The whole multiple universe thing, after Gardner Fox wrote his Flash of Two Worlds story, became one of the best plot devices the comics writers at DC ever had. Finally, they could have Silver Age and Golden Age heroes meet and work together. At first, there was only Earth 1, which was Silver Age, and then Earth 2, Golden Age. Which was odd, because the Golden Age heroes of Earth were older, but since Barry Allen, the Silver Age Flash, remember that, I hope you're taking notes, he was the one who broke the barrier so he gets precedence. Anyway, as I said, at first there were two Earths. That number grew swiftly, for plot and copyright reasons. For example, at a certain point, DC was working on the rights to own characters from the Charlton Comics line, the Blue Beetle, Captain Atom, and so on, and they inhabited Earth 4. Then they went on to obtain characters from Fawcett, who was all Shazam and Captain Marvel, and they went into Earth S. As if the hungry beast that was DC wasn't finished, they put characters from Quality Comics, Uncle Sam, Phantom Lady, the Ray, onto Earth X. Hold on, I will get to the story eventually, I promise. There was Earth 3, where the doppelgangers of our favorite heroes were villains, and the only hero on the planet was Luthor. Then came Earth D, Earth Prime, Earth Omega, and eventually Earth Sigma. Suffice to say, by 1985, there was a huge mess. Older readers had no problem following the continuity, but newcomers were baffled, and writers were no doubt also befuddling themselves. The decision was made to clean the whole thing up. Make one Earth, one timeline, one continuity. No more parallel Earths, no more vibrating, no more dimensional barriers. Sounds really simple, doesn't it? Well, it took 12 issues and the appearance of almost every hero and villain ever seen in DC Comics' 50-year history to pull it off. The research itself took over 3 years, with one guy tasked with studying every single comic DC had printed since 1935. My thought when I heard that was, awesome job, I want to do that! It also required the cooperation of dozens of writers and artists across all of DC's titles, and a company-wide effort to make the crisis a truly universal event. So our story opens with the end of the world, or rather the end of a world, more to the point. A vast white cloud encroaches upon the earth, vaporizing everything in its path, without pause or remorse. Panicking, people try to flee, but to no avail. Into this horror appears a man with dark eyes and a tortured face who watches this world die, helpless and weeping, and vanishes again as the universe becomes nothing more than a mist of free-floating electrons. Not a bad way to start a book. The man is Pariah, and he is condemned to appear wherever great tragedy strikes, unable to help, unable to die, only able to watch. He's there when the crime syndicate of Earth 3 put aside their evil to try and stop the wave of energy that devours their planet. And again, Pariah appears, and again, the world is destroyed. But not before the planet's only superhero, Lex Luthor, rockets his son through the dimensions in the hopes of freeing him from his world's destruction. Sound familiar? I thought so. If you think you're going to know what's going on this quickly, you're wrong. A mysterious figure sends his associate, a woman named Harbinger, who can split herself among many forms to gather heroes from Earths that have not yet been destroyed and bring them to a satellite that hovers in orbit around all of them, oddly enough. While she searches them out, one of her is corrupted by a shadowy evil that tracks her through the ice of Atlantis. She gathers them, heroes, villains, and otherwise, to the satellite, where we first meet a character that had been hovering around various DC titles for a few months, always in the shadows, the Monitor. The Monitor informs them there's great evil abroad, that universes are perishing at an astonishing rate and are doing so at the hand of his adversary. Waves of antimatter are consuming the universes, and with each one gone, the Monitor's power decreases. He has a task for these heroes, spread out over millennia of Earth history. And this is the first attempt to save the worlds. The basic rundown of the story is that there's an antimatter universe out there, created when Krona performed his experiment, controlled by the mirror version of the Monitor. This anti-Monitor wants nothing more than to see his brother dead, and to see the positive universes brought under his control. He's a good old-fashioned evil overlord, I must say. So as each universe is destroyed by the great sweeping cloud of death, he grows ever stronger. Now, It has been pointed out to me that some people out there get all anal about this concept, thereby calling the whole damn plot into question. So, here's a bit of elementary physics out there for you, oh, nitpicky people. The above scenario cannot happen. When matter and antimatter collide, there's a huge burst of energy as the two forms of matter vaporize each other. Nothing is left. In reality physics, both the monitor and the anti-monitor would be playing a zero-sum game. Given that, you know, these people are willing to accept the existence of thousands of metahumans who can perform feats that fly in the face of real physics? I think their arguments about the properties of antimatter are so much hot air. Ha ha ha. Anyway, the antimonitor's release is tied with Pariah's fate as well. You see, determined to do as Krona did, Pariah set up a chamber of matter and antimatter so he could see the beginning of all things. The result was the beginning of the end, and his world was the first consumed by the antimatter wave. The monitor, observing this, imbued him with his curse, using him as a tracker to see which universe might be the next to die. So we have an unstoppable force tearing through the multiverse, and it's up to the monitor and our heroes to stop him. But the monitor dies, and worlds keep dying. Of course, you know, in the end, the good guys win. But, as with any good story, it is the telling of the tale, not necessarily the tale's end, that is important. Wolfman and Perez did some very daring things with this story, not only in rearranging the whole order of the DC Universe, but also in killing off some pretty heavy hitters. The best cover in the series, so good they came out with a statue based on it, was the cover of issue number 7, The Death of Supergirl. The other major character to be killed off was Barry Allen, the Flash, who inadvertently started the whole thing a long time ago. But he died well, and as Marv Wolfman says in the foreword to the collected edition of Crisis, there was a way left to bring him back if they needed to. Indeed, Barry Allen's presence has not yet vanished. The current Flash, Wally West, has long held Barry to be the high ideal to which he must match, but at the same time leave behind. In one version of the Legion of Superheroes books, the character XS, another super speedster, is Barry Allen's granddaughter, and the character Impulse slash Kid Flash is Barry Allen's nephew, so the Flash lives on in his way. In fact, he has recently been resurrected in DC continuity, although how long that will last, that's anyone's guess. On the other hand, no one remembers Supergirl. By the end of the Crisis, she'd been wiped from existence and was seen only once more, in a Christmas issue several years later, reminding the character Dead Man about what it means to work without reward. While several new Supergirls have appeared since then, unlike Barry Allen, the pre-Crisis Supergirl is lost to history. As you might be able to guess, I really like this story. It has an immense cast of characters without becoming unwieldy or dispersed. The storytelling, with its multi-universal scope, nevertheless allows you to feel for individuals with their triumphs and their tragedies. Ultimately, we see that even the mightiest of mortals is, at heart, human. There's foreshadowing galore, mysteries abound, the plot twists and turns, and you get glimpses of what's to come. A hand in this swirling pool of stars, the image of the Flash appearing before Batman and vanishing with words of doom, the Green Lantern's rings sputtering and failing. It all intertwines together so very nicely and really satisfies my inner comics geek. And the Absolute Edition of Crisis, by the way, was aimed at people exactly like me. Somebody who would say, you know, I've read this story a dozen times, I could probably recite it, but I need it to be, you know, bigger. Like, big enough to club a man to death with. So yeah, they had me from the word go on this one, and as soon as the opportunity arose to buy it, I did so without hesitation. It is really pretty, it's been recolored and everything, and it comes with a companion book about how the series came to be. Fascinating reading. The big question, of course, is this. After nearly 25 years and at least two other universe-wide reboots, Zero Hour and Infinite Crisis, that have changed the changes made by Crisis on Infinite Earths, why is the story still worth reading? Well, for one thing, the writing is solid. You can follow the story without having to buy a couple dozen other titles, and there's dramatic moments that have hung in my memory for years. In addition, of course, there is the art. George Perez has been one of my favorite artists for years. His attention to detail and his ability to draw dozens of characters to a page while keeping each of them dynamic, interesting, and individual is, in my opinion, nothing short of superhuman. If I could choose to draw like anyone, it'd be George Perez, and I will never get tired of looking at his artwork. More importantly, however, this book is about the heroic ideal. On many scales, from the small scale of characters like Hawk and Dove or the Losers, all the way up to the big guns of Superman, Flash, and Supergirl. The idea of what it means to be a good person is presented over and over again. You do good not because it's easy, not because it will benefit yourself. You do good because it's what you must do, even when you know it could lead to tragedy for yourself. My model of heroism was formed in these books, and the model set by these characters has guided my moral choices ever since. Where other people take their moral guidance from Jesus or Marcus Aurelius or, I don't know, Oprah, I take mine from Barry Allen and Kara Zor-El and from so many others who put their lives and interests aside for the greater good. Can't ask for much more than that. Now, I said this was a double, and the reason it's a double is because I also have the Crisis on Infinite Earths novelization. Yes, I own them both. Is there something wrong with that? It's all right. Now, this is done by Marv Wolfman. He put it into, you know, print. And here's a little known fact about me. When I was in, I don't know, maybe junior high school, I tried to novelize Crisis. I sat down with the comics and I went through them, panel by panel, trying to put them into a narrative form. I tried to fill in things like expressions and reactions to kind of bridge the gap between the kind of story you can tell in a comic and the kind you tell in a novel. And to my memory, it was pretty good, although it's no doubt lost to the ages by now. If I ever run across it, I'll either marvel at my innocent youth or cringe at my fumbling attempts to, well, frankly, do the unnecessary. I'm not the only one who gave it some thought, though. To his credit, since Marv Wolfman was the guy who wrote the comics, I think he had far more right to put it into novel form than I ever did. But whereas mine was a straight page-by-page translation of the comic to text, Wolfman decided to tell the story from a very different angle. He decided to let us see the Crisis on Infinite Earths through the eyes of Barry Allen, the Flash. As I said before, Barry Allen was pretty much the beginning of the multiverse in DC Comics, so it was fitting that he be the one to narrate the end in this book. After all, he didn't get that much page time in the comics. A few ghostly visitations, a little bit of taunting, and, you know, then he was dead. Yes, his death saved billions, if not trillions, of people, but, you know, for someone as important as he was, you would have thought he'd have gotten more pages. You know, the thing about the Flash, though, is he's real hard to pin down, literally. Even on an ordinary day, we're talking about a man who can race laser beams and win. He can alter his subjective view of time to the point where a hummingbird in flight becomes still life. He can run fast enough to travel through time and vibrate the very molecules of his body to a point where he can not only ghost through solid matter, but pass between the dimensional barriers that separate the multiple Earths. Honestly, how any villain ever got the best of this man is beyond me. If the writers had ever taken his powers seriously, the Flash would never have had a challenge. So who better to narrate our alternate view of the Crisis than he? The fact he's dead by the time the book begins doesn't seem to make much difference. There's too much for the Flash to do, and suddenly, the fastest man alive does not have enough time. So I don't really need to reiterate what Crisis was about, why it happened, who the main players were. None of that has changed in this version of the story. We just have a different point of view. And from this point of view, we learn many interesting things the comic held back from us, such as the relationship between the Monitor and his young ward Lila, who would eventually become Harbinger. He knew, even before he found her, that she would kill him. In fact, she would have to kill him if any of the Earths were to survive the coming apocalypse. We get a much better look at the Psycho Pirate, the mad puppet of the Anti-Monitor, whose ability to manipulate emotions becomes key to control of worlds. And we get first-person views from so many other heroes and villains that took part in the Crisis, getting a much deeper look at the work. Most of all, of course, we get to see Barry Allen. What drives him, even in this semi-dead state, to continue to play an active part? He's incorporeal and largely unable to interact with, let alone avert, the catastrophe. But he remains a witness until the time comes that he's able to, with a little bit of time travel cheating, free himself from his bonds and go to a death that he knows he cannot avoid, and which he also knows isn't the end. Honestly, how he survives beyond death the way he does is not very clear in the book. It has something to do with the Speed Force, I think, a kind of semi-sentient energy field that grants speedsters their powers and provides them a heaven when they die. His jaunts through time and space seem to be at the control of a higher power, but exactly who and what that higher power is, we're never quite sure of. Now, as with any transition from one medium to another, there are changes. The villainous takeover of three Earths is gone, for example, as is the involvement of Superboy Prime, and much of what occurs after the Anti-Monitor's ultimate defeat is completely different. And therefore, if you've been keeping up with the DC Universe over the past 3 years or so, decidedly non-canon. But Supergirl's death is expanded on, and we get to see the decisions that bring her to her doom. We know that, like Barry Allen, she did what needed to be done, knowing that it would be her end. Getting a quick look inside her head before she took on the Anti-Monitor honestly makes her death just that much more poignant. But, you know, as with any transition from one medium to another, it's very hard to compare the new rendition to the original. While this novelized version of Crisis is a quick and enjoyable read, it doesn't have nearly the scope and the depth, and especially the visual punch, the comic did. Because the comics are such a visual medium, a story told in mixed media, you're gonna lose something when you take one of those media away. While I enjoy reading this, and it is a lot easier to carry around than the Rosetta Stone-sized Absolute editions, it's never gonna take the place of the original. Wolfman is an excellent writer of comics. He's not a novelist. So, if you're a fan of Crisis, and you just want another look at the old story, pick it up. If you have never read Crisis before, get your hands on the comics and let this one come to you later. So, that is it. Reviews of both the comic and the novelization. I know you are just about ready to pass out from shock. So, let me give you a quote, and then a clue, and then I'll let you go, because I'm sure you have many things to do today. In fact, two quotes. The first, of course, is the one from the comic, which was sort of the tagline for the whole series. And it was said by Psycho Pirate at the very end of the last issue. He said, "Worlds lived, worlds died. Nothing will ever be the same." That was the tag, and it was what got people's attention on the series. From the novelization, we have a line from Supergirl, which is not in the comic, which is why I chose it. And she's talking to Barry Allen. She says, "Barry, I know people die. From the moment I understood what they meant, I was very aware of all the memorials around me. But my mother, God bless her, Barry, she said and kept saying until I believed her, that although we have to remember the dead, we can't ever let ourselves act like we're one of them." So, there we go. That is Crisis on Infinite Earths, the Absolute edition of the comic, and the novelization, both by Marv Wolfman. I hope you enjoyed that. Like I said, I am a full-fledged, full-blown comic book geek. I could go on for much longer, if you like, but I don't think you would like that. I could review each issue. I really could. Would you like that? No, I didn't think so. Not everybody is quite as single-minded as I am when it comes to comics. So, as I said before, I'd like to thank you all for a good year. I hope to have another good year this year. I'm thinking of a couple of changes to the website that I'll keep you abreast on when I have a little more time to do it. Tonight I'm under a little bit of time pressure, but that's okay. So, thank you very much. Let me give you a clue to next week's book. We're going to stay in the superhero theme, because I do love my superheroes, and you know, much like heroin, it's hard to stop doing. We all love our superheroes. We all love seeing Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman and The Flash, and alright, fine, Spider-Man and X-Men and Hulk, doing what they do. Big question? Why? Not why do we love them. Why do they do what they do? Next week's book will attempt to answer that. So, send me your guess by email. The address is at the end of the podcast. Come to the blog and leave a comment. Join me on Twitter at LabLib. Go to Facebook. Join up. Become a fan. What else can you do? You can go to iTunes. You can leave a review on iTunes. You can write down the URL everywhere. Spray paint it on the side of buildings. I think I mentioned this before. You can tattoo it onto your forehead. You can speak it as a mantra when you get angry on the bus because people aren't letting you sit down. There's a million things you can do. Spread the word, ladies and gentlemen. Because, you know, someday, maybe next year, we will be an internet force to be reckoned with. Yes, we will be one of the great podcasts. And I will destroy all the other podcasts in a blaze of antimatter and fire and... Oh, I'm sorry, that was inside voice. Okay, well, thank you again for listening to me this week ramble on. Thank you for sticking with me for the year. I look forward to another great year with you. And I will see you next week. A text version of this review will be up on the blog, thelabyrinthlibrary.blogspot.com, along with any relevant links I can think of. If you have anything you want to say or any suggestions you'd like to make, please leave a comment and let me know. If you have a book you'd like to recommend, I'd be happy to hear it. If you would like to send me some email, send it to labyrinthlibrary@gmail.com. And if you like what you hear, please give a review on iTunes or become a fan on Facebook. This podcast is covered by a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives license, so feel free to share it, but please don't sell it or change it. The music is courtesy of Kevin MacLeod at www.incompetech.com. Thanks for listening. I'll be back next week, and until then, keep reading.